Hi, I'm Paul Johnson. I'm with the Optimistic American. Politicians, political parties, the nightly news, and for that matter, social media, they spend an incredible amount of time trying to terrify you about today's conditions. They create this distorted view of what's really going on in the world. And in the process, oftentimes people begin to lose hope. They begin to lose a belief in the future, and they don't understand the opportunities that exist in front of them. Now, I've worked with lots of different groups as mayor. I've been involved in issues that were terrorizing to many of the people who were involved with them. Neighborhoods that have been hit hard by crime, police departments that were dealing with issues that are almost unbelievable. Civil rights groups who were concerned about what was taking place inside their neighborhood on a nightly basis were in our communities. What would happen is as they would become terrorized, it would be hard for them to actually move forward. And I found that there were a series of steps that if I could work them through, it would have an incredible effect on being able to accomplish your results. Now, I did that over and over again, and my guest today, Emily Bascia, has done the same thing as a clinical psychologist. Together, we've worked to form what we call the 7 steps of hope, the steps to help you regain your sense of agency and navigate your way through this highly divisive world that exists today. Now, one of those steps that we're going to talk about today is called love and connection. Love and connection is an absolutely essential part of you being able to regain your sense of agency. If you believe in this message and you want to help us carry it forward, to help pull Americans back together and to give them their sense of agency, I hope that you'll push the subscribe button and for that matter, that you'll push it on to other friends and family members who you think may also need some help in this area. Again, I'm Paul Johnson. I'm here with Emily Bascia today, Dr. Bascia, and we're going to talk about hope. Thank you. Dr. Bascia, welcome. Thanks for being on the show again today.
Thank you so much, Paul, for having me. So as you said before, these 7 codes are so critical and so important for people improving their lives, the quality of their lives, and creating meaning in their lives. But really, none is more important for enhancing self-agency than the code of love and connection.
Yes, and that's going to be a fun one, I think, to talk about. What I thought maybe we would do is try to separate it. We'll start with talking about connection. It's a little different than love, but it's certainly in the same genre. But let's start by talking about that issue on its own. And what I want to do is I'm going to give a story from a book. As you know, I like to read a lot, and I love stories. I think stories are one of the great ways to really be able to transmit a message.
You have great stories, yes.
Yeah. Well, this book was called Younger Next Year. It's mm-hmm. a little dated today. Maybe it's about 10 years old. But Younger Next Year was a book that was designed to try and tell people how to stay young the rest of their life. And the theory was that that inside of each one of us, that we're mammals, and that we go through these seasons. And the last season, which is winter, things begin to die inside of each one of us. Mm-hmm. And that literally that can happen on an annual basis, and that there are things that we can do that will improve our ability to stay younger. It's written by a cellular biologist. Again, I don't want to go too deep into it. I just want to tell the story.
It's about like rejuvenation.
Right. And the two items that most people would identify with quickly would be your diet and exercise. Right. Mm-hmm. And that both of those two things that are very helpful. And by the way, his view of diet is very different than many books that you read. His view is if you don't keep eating a variety of foods and if you starve yourself, then you're telling your body you're dying and it puts into place the wrong things. It actually mm-hmm. goes in the wrong direction. But my favorite part of his book was how much emphasis he placed on the importance of staying connected to other human beings. The story that he tells, we just came back from Africa, and I think we saw this in a very significant way. But, you know, you'll have this herd of deer, and in this herd of deer, there will always be a male buck that's in the center. It's the strongest male buck. The other bucks will live outside the herd. They'll live alone, or they'll travel maybe with one other buck.
Yes, but this is the alpha male that has
right.
control.
The alpha male's on the inside.
All the females.
The females then surround mm-hmm. them, and then all the other bucks live alone on the outside, mm-hmm. and they're fine. One day, one of those younger bucks goes from the outside to the inside, challenges the alpha male, and beats him. And when he beats him, the alpha male moves to the outside. Now, unlike the other bucks, that alpha male never lasts for more than 6 months. He dies very quickly, right? That sense of loss becomes so big, he can't survive. The idea that we have people who have been married for 50 years and one spouse dies and 6 months later the other one dies, that's not a statistical anomaly, right? That happens because there's this loss of connection. It plays a huge role. One of our prior shows in the show about meaning, we talked about Viktor Frankl talking about how frail life was in a concentration camp and how when somebody lost the will to live, they died sometimes days later. It was very obvious to see how that mattered. Well, connection, being connected to other human beings is important, and not being connected to them can have huge impacts on your health and your well-being.
Yeah, and you have a saying that I really love that I think is poignant for this topic right now is when you say that somebody who has something and loses it versus the person that has nothing and is only has something to gain, that's the person to really be afraid of or be concerned about. Because they're the ones who are more destitute, more desperate, and maybe more willing to take drastic measures that could be harmful.
Yeah, that's all taken from a book called The True Believer by Eric Hoffer. Mm-hmm. And what Eric Hoffer talks about is that,
you don't
have to worry about a generation that has a lot and wants more, and you don't have to worry about the generation that has nothing and wants something. You only have to worry about the generation that has something and feels like they lost a piece of it. Now, I happen to think that loss is mostly illusory. It's what you're watching on the nightly news. It's what you're watching in social media. It's what you're hearing from political parties. But if you really take a look at where we are in society, we haven't lost anything. We've gained massive amounts of ground.
And so much of that is perspective.
But they want to take your sense of agency from you, to turn you against other groups, to turn you against other people. And the consequences of that can be detrimental for our society, which is a big part of why this show is here, which is to help give you that agency back. And while one of the things you have to do that is to know the truth, you also have to find the fifth step is you have to find love and connection. And connection, there's all types of health consequences that are tied to people who don't have that sense of connection.
Yes, there's some recent research that has looked at social alienation and disconnection and loneliness is linked to increased heart rate as much as heart disease as much as 29% and increased strokes as much as 32%. So these are really high statistics. I think there was even some other studies and research saying the leading cause of death is loneliness, greater than diabetes, greater than smoking, which is amazing to think how much loneliness really impacts us. I think during the impacts of COVID, especially aging populations who were really isolated, and there was a lot of concerns of exposure to COVID to aging populations, so many people died of loneliness. And so it's heartbreaking to really consider what are the true health impacts of loneliness and social alienation. I see that a lot in the forensic work that I do as well. You know, the people who have been pushed out, just as you were talking about, you know, with the mammals, that if there's a fighting male that is trying to assert dominance or power and loses and gets pushed out to the outside, or their problem and that group is pushing them to the outside, they're living on the fringes of society, and I see that all the time. And so these people never truly get socialized, and it can happen from a young age. And there's something that isn't quite programmed quite right. They're missing empathy. They're missing connection. They're missing a sense of belonging. And, you know, it leads them to do drastic things to be paid attention to and to get attention. Sometimes you'll hear of the problem child who has the problem behaviors. They're acting out for attention. Really, that's the only way. Even if it ends up being negative reinforcement or they're being punished, they're still getting the attention. So we want to be able to say, how can we still keep people in those fringes of society connected to us? I did a lot of world travels, and one thing that I was always amazed at is, you know, when I was in Cuba, I thought, wow, like, you can't be suicidal in this community. Like, everyone's in everyone's business. There's no way that you can isolate yourself and become suicidal. Like, people are going to know. You can't hide that. Mm-hmm. People are always going to be in your business and coming into your space and coming into your house, as much as it may be an irritant or an annoyance. But you know that you belong to this community. Even if you do things that might be punished, or there may be unintended consequences for it, that's going to happen. And so there's a lot of value to that. You know, there's something that really holds you to the group, and I think that creates so many protective buffers.
You know, I think I mentor a lot of people, and I think a part of this is age-related, some part of it, although I found a lot of loneliness amongst seniors. I can recall as mayor, I would go to a senior center, and when I would start to shake hands with people after giving a speech, sometimes people would line up along the wall to shake my hand. And it wasn't anything special about me. It was the fact that they were getting a chance to meet whoever the mayor was. These were people who oftentimes were alone in their home all day long without any visitors or anyone seeing them. And this free lunch was the one thing that they got that gave them companionship. But what I also find is that, you know, in your 20s, people, they all think that there's this magical structure that they're going to fit into one day. And they're trying to figure out where their place is. By the time you get to your 30s, you kind of begin to recognize that the structure is a bit illusory, and that while there are people who may be doing better or worse than you, that you do fit in, that you have a role that you can play. By the time you get to your 40s, you realize not only is the structure illusory, but the idea that you have anybody who thinks that they actually aren't seeking that same thing, that also is illusory. I mean, I think Elon Musk is a great example. He's having, you know, this week his father came on line, Errol, and he made some pretty damning statements about his son, at least from my standpoint. And you never know with the media. I mean, they definitely distort things, so I may not have a good reading of it. Now, admittedly, I think Elon Musk is one of the heroes of our generation. That doesn't mean I agree with him on everything, but this is a guy who he created Tesla.
Such
he created
an innovator
SpaceX.
And
he's,
creator.
You know, he's focused on getting us to Mars. He invented PayPal. He's just been driven to create these amazing things, all of which are dramatically improving our lives. And I think Tesla's not just improving, not only have they created a great car, they force Chevy, Ford, and other companies to step up to the plate.
Yeah, he's first, driven it such an intensity.
Yeah, and he's moving mankind forward. Mm-hmm. But it's not lost on me that he has some huge insecurities, that in dealing with the media sometimes and things that he says that are a bit awkward, that he's a bit challenged on being able to fit in. And when you listen to his father's comments, which, by the way, made me love him even more, right? It was like, okay, you're a human being.
You see the dysfunction and the flaws.
And you have a father just like everybody else does, a mother just like everyone else does. And
who's invalidating and emotionally abusive.
Right, and some my father was a great father, but there are, you know, sometimes people out there who do bad things. And his bad thing is just invalidating his son's success and making him feel like he's not all that he can be. Now, again,
sounds
I don't know that.
Sounds to me like his father's envious.
That's what it sounds to me like also. Mm-hmm. It sounds to me like his
of
father's
his
so self-centered.
Success.
He can't think of anything else other than himself. But again, I'm going to just give a little bit of credence to right. It is the media, and I don't really know what's going on in their life. But I do know this. Everybody at every level is trying to fit in. We all put our pants on exactly the same. The question becomes, does it matter to you or not? If you want to fit in, there are ways that you can find to do it, to be able to go out and to make friends and to be able to fit in with other people. Now, unfortunately, I think we've gotten to this stage where we think that fitting in can somehow or another be done on social marketing. Right? We think that it can be done on
social
Facebook.
Social media, different platforms.
Right. What
all the likes and friends.
Oh, exactly. So what, you know, by the way, those are powerful words, right? Mm-hmm. When you think about it, I just made a friend on Facebook. They liked what it was that I had.
Well,
to
even
say.
I just asked you before the start of this podcast, how's our other podcast doing? Are they being viewed? Are they being liked?
Exactly, right? We all want affirmation, right? It's universal, and there's nothing.
Is it making a difference?
Wrong with that, right?
Is there any interest? Is it being helpful?
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, but, there is that question.
But the challenge with social marketing is, I think there are two big ones. The first one is, just because you find agreement with people who all hate someone else or something else, that's not connection. You can't be connected by just agreeing that you hate someone else collectively.
Yeah, you're not having all the benefits that you would get from connection, commitment, sense of belonging, because ultimately, you know, is that person going to show up for you when you're sick in bed and you need someone to drive your kid to school or help bring you a meal because, you know, you're quarantining because you have COVID? You know, who are the people in your life that you can really lean on and depend on? People that just like you, it's superfluous. It's a very superficial relationship. They're not going to be showing up for you in your life when you need them. So you're not benefiting in the same way that you would from deeper connection and belonging. I just wanted to go back to Elon Musk. I mean, he's got such a fascinating life story and autobiography and career. And I don't know. I haven't tried to really dissect what happened to his family and upbringing. But he does talk about that history of being bullied, not feeling like he fit in, that there was a lot of shaming and invalidating in his family origin and all this family dysfunction. I do hear a lot of that in the clinical work from people that I'm working with. And so one of the main things is, what are the core beliefs? What are your driving factors? Elon Musk, he's a maniac. I mean, he is such a driver at creating and pushing the boundaries and going. He's not the kind of person that I think, that's a peaceful person, or that person has inner peace. He is so driven. Even people that know him will talk about this intensity about him. And we all benefit from that. But it is a sickness in him. I can't imagine that it's good or healthy on his body and being. But people who grew up in those environments ultimately have core beliefs that they're inadequate, they're incompetent, that they're undeserving of love, that they don't have any self-worth or self-value. And then those core beliefs get buried in so many other things. And there are so many other assumptions about themselves and the world and others and their relationships that it's really hard to pinpoint. And so they'll constantly be repeating these different patterns over and over and over again. And this is where habits get formed. And people will say, you know, I don't know why I keep ending up in these dysfunctional relationships, or I don't know why I keep ending up with these narcissistic partners. And I would ultimately say, what does that say about you? You know, let's not talk about them anymore. Because sometimes when you shift that focus to blaming the other person, again, you're losing your self-agency. You don't have that control and power anymore. You're seeing yourself as a victim to the circumstance and allowing yourself to be dominated by other people. And I'm saying, let's shift that power back to you. Let's try and trace, what were your thoughts leading up to this? What were your behaviors leading up to this? What are you manifesting for yourself that are attracting these kinds of people to your life? What kinds of trauma are you repeating because you haven't dealt with that childhood trauma from back there? It's so common to see people growing up with alcoholic parents end up with an alcoholic. And then they say, you know, what does this say about me? Like, everyone's treated me this way in my life, like trash. I'm just so easily discarded. And it's not unusual to find that person then saying, all I want to do is prevent abandonment. It's like, well, why are you choosing these people who are more likely going to betray you and abandon you? And I would, again, come back to the self. Do you trust yourself? What would it take to trust yourself? Mm-hmm. Are you a people pleaser? If you're a people pleaser, you're constantly going to be putting your energy out towards the other and measuring yourself up against whether or not you're liked.
And maybe the answer, also the question has to be asked, is that really making you happy? You know,
Is it really you?
Mother Teresa was a people pleaser, and I met her. I can tell you, I think it really did make her happy to be able to please and help other people. But that's, it would be a mistake to say she didn't believe in conflict. In fact, she had this senior home, I remember, that she was going to build in Phoenix for poor people. And the council person in the district who was Hispanic, who I really cared a lot about, but she didn't want this project to happen because there was neighborhood opposition to it. So when Mother Teresa came to town and met with us, she just did this beautiful little talk about what was going on in the community and nationally, and tens of thousands of people came out to see her. And then she asked for a meeting with me by myself. She's all of about, I don't remember, she's under 5 foot tall, just this little teeny tiny woman. And
but intimidating and powerful.
Well, she then said, so where are you on my senior home that I'm building, or the group house that I'm building? I said, well, the council person from the district has some concerns, and she's blah, 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 blah. She goes, I didn't ask you about the council person in the district. I asked you about you. Uh-huh. Where are you on this issue? Of course, I started to sweat down both sides. I began.
You don't want to piss off Mother Teresa.
Right? And I said, well, she goes, I need
whether
a commitment.
You believe in karma,
are you
or
going
not
to vote for this or not? I go, I'm voting for it. Mm-hmm. I'm in, right? So it went back to the other side, and the council person from the district came and chewed me out and said, I can't believe that you didn't stick with your commitment with me. I go, well, you talked to her. By the time she got done talking to her, she came to me. She goes, you're right. We're going to have to get this passed. But
I love it. Concede to Mother Teresa when in doubt.
But she loved helping other people. Mm-hmm. And I think that we always should think about how we can help other people. Mm-hmm. But we also have to think about, how do we love ourselves? How do we find mm-hmm. peace within ourselves? And what I am positive of is you're not going to find it in social marketing. You know, these companies, these multi-billion dollar companies, have built out these networks that are based upon this concept that they're going to give you friends and give you likes, and that people are going to see your children's stories. But there's a darker side to this nirvana. Mm-hmm. And the darker side to it is that it doesn't sell, it doesn't duplicate itself nearly as much as negative information. Mm-hmm. So once you start taking a look at being negative, all of a sudden other groups can begin to feed into it. And then they begin to distract you out to other types of social sites like 4chan or 8chan, things other than Facebook, where it becomes even darker and more negative. It's a rabbit hole. And that rabbit hole benefits financially these companies, but it doesn't really benefit the individual. If you really want to find connection, I agree with you. You have to figure out what it is that you want, but you also have to be willing to extend yourself out to other people. You have to be vulnerable. You have to be willing to talk to people. You have to go to places where you can meet other people. And it's not just about finding romantic love, which seems to be the focus. It's about finding connection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that could be through business. It could be through support systems. It could be through volunteering. It could be through workplace. Mm-hmm. There's always opportunities mm-hmm. to create connection on your hikes, and you're passing other fellow hikers by. Right. There's always opportunities. A local coffee shop that you frequent, take the time to really get to know, okay, what is this person? What are their stressors? What motivates them? Mm-hmm. Get to know them. So oftentimes, I'll hear people say, oh, I feel like I don't belong in this space. I feel like awkward. I feel like everyone's kind of fake and phony in this room. I feel like I don't belong, and it's making me super self-conscious. Then I end up kind of laughing at jokes that I don't even think are funny, and I feel like this imposter, and I don't really belong in this room. And I would say, no, you have the right to exist. You have the right to speak up. You have the right to be seen. You have the right to be heard. If you're the one that's holding yourself back because of all these other things that you're telling yourself, you're the one that's giving up your power. You're the one that's giving away your self-agency. And you have to believe that you are deserving. Mm-hmm. You are deserving.
All right. So what is antisocial behavior?
So antisocial behavior, oftentimes people will talk about it as somebody that lacks social skills. They'll say, oh, they're antisocial. But in the way that we talk about it clinically, that's not correct. The way that we talk about it clinically is it's really a population of people who over time have developed this personality condition that is pervasive and it's prolonged. So it's across various settings, and it's long-term, and where people really lack a sense of empathy. They lack a sense of connection. They're more willing to manipulate you, to take advantage of you. They're very goal-driven, and they don't mind using people. And you'll see this in different settings. It may cause them legal consequences, and there's going to be other implications. And for them, there is no like empathy or compassion for other people that they might be using.
Now, what I like about this definition, what percent of the public would you think have that actual condition?
Well, I mean, you can say majority of people who are incarcerated might, you know, have met this criteria, but there's really only 1% of the population who would really meet the criteria of being psychopaths. You know, very extreme forms of that social deviancy. But you might find somebody whose life experiences have led them to lead antisocial lives. And it's been reinforced because they've been able to take advantage of people. They haven't really had true opportunity to be successful.
There's so much we can learn from that behavior, in that we can recognize that if we do the opposite of those things, that we're going to find a whole different level of success. Meaning we may not have the pathology that the that person has. But if we can say, you know what, I'm going to be empathetic. I'm going to listen to other people. I'm going to try to understand where they're coming from. I'm going to put their needs a little bit in front of mine. I'm going to, I'm not going to be selfish in the way that I approach this. That there are things that you can learn from them that you can apply in life, knowing, hey, if I just do these things, I'm going to build more friends. I'm going to have a better life. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to end up being in a position where I'm isolated and where I'm locked out.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I'll have this opportunity to like read sometimes tens of thousands of pages of records on a person before I go to see them. And I've got such a distorted perception of them before I see them. And then when I meet them and I start asking them questions and they start telling me about their childhood and their history and how they think about the world and their lives and their relationships and how all these people have hurt them and harmed them and how that made them into this hostile person. But really, ultimately, they're broken and they want love and they've been constantly abandoned and rejected and abused. They live in a hostile world. And even things in like South Phoenix, you wouldn't even think about that. Like we live in the United States and it sounds like they're in a war-torn territory, or in Chicago, you know, and I think about that. I'm like, well, they hear bullets every day and that becomes a daily part of their life. And they become desensitized to that. And, you know, knowing about the losses in their life, they have a best friend who was murdered. They have a family member who was murdered. They have other family members who are in prison for life because they murdered somebody. And it's just constantly engrossed in their life. But when I meet with them, human to human, across the table, I mean, sure, there's a power differential that's there. But oh my gosh, it's such a different picture that is portrayed. And I really, you know, I try to put that into the work that I do to humanize this person. Again, not condoning that what they did wasn't wrong, but at least humanizing, like, how did this person get there? How did they get to be who they are?
Mm-hmm. You know, I spent a lot of time in those kinds of neighborhoods where those challenges exist. You know, I listened to the debate today where there's kind of a lot of disagreement between Black Lives Matter and police departments. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, it's possible I've been to too many police officers' funerals to have a completely objective point of view on this. Mm-hmm. But what I can tell you is that when you break it down and you get people to talk, it's amazing how things change. You know, if I were to go into a neighborhood that was a minority neighborhood, and I were to tell them, okay, so part of why you're being followed more by police officers is you have 4 times more police officers in this neighborhood than wealthy neighborhoods have, which is a fact. It almost is always true. You, mm-hmm. The way you deploy departments is you put more people into areas where there's a higher crime rate. Mm-hmm. And those people who are in those police cars that are doing that, if you would like, I can promise you that the wealthier neighborhood would like to have more of these police officers back in their area. Yeah.
Right? Maryville versus Fountain Hills.
Right. Well, that's a Phoenix model. But I've been in cities all over the country. Yeah. I've campaigned for presidential candidates all over the country. It's always the same.
Yeah.
Right? It just is. Mm-hmm. Well, if you did that, those minority neighborhoods would go crazy and say, you know, what had happened is the shop owner who says, hey, you're breaking into my yard, stealing, or people stealing from me on a nightly basis. Don't be taking cops away from me.
Protection.
Or the guy who owns a small 7-Eleven and he's being broken into. Or the mom whose baby's sleeping in bathtubs because drive-by shootings are happening on their neighborhood on a nightly basis. Mm-hmm. And by the way, when that police officer is driving in that neighborhood, they're hearing those shots. And that begins to make them worried about whether or not they're going to go home. And that creates a whole different psychology for them than exists in the other neighborhood. But if you can get them to talk, if you can get neighbors and police officers to talk who care about their neighborhood and who care about the community, it is amazing the results that you can find. Now, that to me comes back to what I found as one of my steps was love. Love is important. Now, I think we get confused on love. So in this section where we're talking about it, what I'd like to do is I'd like to try to divide love up.
Okay.
So the Greeks had seven different terms for love, which I think was much more useful than the one that we have. Martin Luther King, who was someone who I greatly admired, and Martin Luther King had problems. There's no doubt you can look back at his issues. They were issues. But he moved forward the idea that all individuals deserve dignity. And to me, that's the standard as an American. When I look at Thomas Jefferson or Martin Luther King, I say, did you move that standard forward or did you move it backwards? Did you move the collective forward or did you move individualism forward? And
it's
Martin Luther,
measure.
Yeah, he moved it forward for us. But he said, let's take these seven measures, let's turn them into three. Now, the three that he used, he was a preacher, so he took them from the Bible. It was eros was one, philia was two, and then the third one was agape, all right? And the first one, eros, was romantic love, right? Now, what's interesting about romantic love, that's one that we usually are thinking about when we talk about love, but romantic love, it's pointed out by him that it's more selfish, right? Not that it's bad, it's not bad at all, but we come into a relationship wanting that passion, that joy, sometimes sex. We want to feel good about who we are with the person that we're with.
To feel desired.
We talk about the chemistry and the magic that comes with it. Mm-hmm. Consequently, it's a bit more selfish, but nonetheless, it's important, and people want it, and they should be able to have it. Philia, it ends up...
can become addictive, too.
It can become addictive. Mm-hmm. I think definitely people can become addicted to it because philia, which is in Martin Luther's term, is kind of a combination of others, but it meant brotherly love. In fact, Philadelphia is, their slogan is the city of brotherly love. Mm. Philia means brotherly love. That's the name actually means that, right? And by the way, the opposite of philia in Greek is phobia, right? Fear. Fear, love. Fear, love. They're on opposite ends of the equation. But philia is more family and brotherhood and sisterhood. It's instead of being a binary decision, it's more both sides end up having a benefit from it. Now, the eros relationship, the romantic relationship, can grow into that, right? You can grow into this sense of, no, this is no longer just the person I'm romantically involved with. This is my family. This is somebody who I have to protect, and I have to make certain that they're taken care of.
So it's more selfless.
Right. It's more selfless. It's not completely selfless because you're getting something back out of it. Mm. But it's, you know, in the Nordic words, they had the word troth and troost, right? Mm-hmm. Troth was, I take care of my family, all right? I take care of the tribe. And because I have this troth, which for us became truth, right? Truth came from troth. People can trust me, which came from troost, right?
Yeah, there is this loyalty and commitment, you know, that you can depend on this person to be there for you. Mm-hmm. You know, and I really think that love and defining love, and I don't have all the answers for this, and it's such an ubiquitous word. And if you look at in other languages, there are just so many other definitions for love and other words associated to love. Even our language limits us. We can't necessarily define it purely with the English language. This is where art and music and other things can help us express what's going on and what we're feeling when it comes to love. But for me, and, you know, in the work that I've done and what I've learned, is that there is something about trust. That is such a critical part of love and in building that intimate bond and that relationship. And there's a lot of research looking at trust and commitment and mutuality and mutual respect, that ability to influence another person and that person's ability to influence you, and that being a measure of success in relationships, because there's this constant give and take and shared meaning that's happening, that you are co-constructing your reality, and that there's magic in there. And especially if you can trust that person to be able to be vulnerable and to show your weaknesses and to express your insecurities and your needs from that person, while also being whole and being your own wholesome, independent person. You know, one of the things that leads to betrayal in marriages, the greatest predictor of divorce is loneliness. And so that's the one thing that we see is people who are in marriages and feeling unseen, unheard, not valued, not respected. You know, can you imagine being with a partner that you admire, you respect and love? These are my three personal values and traits and things that I want in a relationship. And I feel that I have, and I feel so grateful and lucky that I do have that. And I think it's sad to think of all these other relationships that don't have that mutual respect.
Yeah, that the word trust, it's so important. And it's important for multiple reasons. One, I agree with you that you can't, that it's a key element to at least philia love, and for that matter, eros love. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about agape in a moment, but for those two, it's important, not just because you want to trust the other partner, but you have to be able to have conversations. Look, we all of us have conflicts. We just do, right? We, you know, I want A, you want B. I'd like to go here, you'd like to go there. Mm-hmm. I'd like to have 25 kids, you'd like to have one, right? There's all these things that are in a relationship. Sex can become a big one. You know, mm-hmm. How often do you want sex? Well, if you don't have trust, you cannot have a conversation. Now, even with trust, people oftentimes won't have the conversation, mm-hmm. which means they really don't have trust in the other person. But once you gain trust in the other person, you know that, hey, if I mess up, I like to call it pre-forgiveness, mm-hmm. that you know that I might mess up in what I'm about to mm-hmm. say, and that you'll pre-forgive me. Mm-hmm. All right, you'll give mm-hmm. me a chance to try to explain it and to try to say what it is that I mean. And oftentimes, I didn't know what I meant exactly when I said it. It was a disjointed idea, but there's enough trust with me and you to know, hey, I've got something that's on my mind and I need to talk about it and I need to filter it and I need to sort it out and I need help, right? And if you can't trust people, well, then you can't sort it out. You have to just kind of do it by yourself.
Yeah, and in that instance with pre-forgiveness, I think, you know, you've built the core of the relationship and there is a strong bond that's there that you've invested in creating that you're able to say, okay, this is a minor thing. Ultimately, I know this person loves me. They're not going to abandon me. They're not going to leave me. They're committed to me. And maybe this other minor thing felt like it was going against the grain, but I'm not going to be constantly attacking that person or disgracing that person or minimizing them. Because as soon as you start to engage in that pattern, at that frequency, you're then leading more towards having a fractured relationship.
Amazingly enough, back to the purpose of kind of why we've done this,
which is a power struggle,
which is how we allow these huge divisions that are happening mm-hmm. in our communities, what we're watching on the nightly news, to become something that divide us from people who we love, right? And I've been guilty of this. In everything I do, I tend to do it with people. I have a running club and I have a group of people who I send out, I think I send out 80 texts a morning, and I don't know, 5 or 25 will show up on any given day. And we have talks. And these are people I've been running with, many of them for 30 years, 35 years. I go to the movies on Sundays and I invite 80 family members to it, right? And we have conversations. Well, in those conversations, oftentimes it will turn to politics. That just mm-hmm. happens. And I I really do care a lot about politics. It matters a lot to me. But in those conversations, sometimes people will say something that is offensive to me, and I'll shoot back and embarrass them or upset them or make them feel bad. And I've created divisions between me and people I love by those comments, right? Now, fortunately, in many of my groups when we do this, you know, I see as kind of like old people sitting on a park bench. We like to go out to the park bench and argue and fight, and then one might storm off angry, but they come back the next day to the park bench because they kind of want to be a part of the communication.
And there's a way to disagree respectfully.
And I come down to this, you know, don't give up on the people that you love for the people you don't even know, right? And maybe more importantly, if it's selfless, if you really care about them, instead of your answer being, you know, I can't believe that you would support that, you're going to undermine the country, that maybe the right response is, well, I don't have that same feeling, but I really want to understand why you feel that way. And dig in and try to understand it. It's not designed to change your mind. It's designed to try to build the connection between them, trust between them, where you know that you're not going to let some silly political issue get between you. And again, I spent my life in politics, but the one strong piece of advice that I would give to people, do not let politics stand in the way of your relationships. It will harm you. You will lose your sense of agency. You will lose your sense of self. It's not nearly as important as the people that you love and the people that you care about.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to knowing your truth and knowing who you are. And, you know, if you are a cynic or you're likely to engage in self-betrayal, and or if you're self-judgmental and you're judgmental of other people, you're going to be constantly separating yourself and looking for comparisons and possibly blaming and externalizing all of your internal problems. And so I would say, look at your life. Mm-hmm. You know, are you satisfied? Do you feel alone? Are you happy where you are? You know, if you're irate and self-righteous and constantly blaming the world and others and your family members, or even your abusers for that matter, how is that helping you? Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would just go back to, what is it that you want to feel at the end of the day? When you go to sleep at night, do you want to sleep with a light sense of consciousness and wake up feeling light and eager and ready to start your day and feeling empowered? Or do you want to go to sleep feeling weighted because you feel like you're living a lie? And it's not uncommon to fall into that trap. I see that with imposter syndrome. People will often say, well, I feel like I've had to live this lie my whole life, and people like this person that I'm portraying. People want to be with that person, but it's exhausting because it's not really me. And I think, don't go another day living that lie. That is not going to help you, whether it's happening in your family or in your marriage or in your workplace. There is no reason why you have to continue living that lie. And once you confront it, sure, there's going to be humiliation. There's going to be shame. That's not going to feel good. But over time, you're going to find power in your story. And I encourage you, keep telling your story. Don't run away from it. Don't shy from it. And in fact, you're going to actually find strength in it. And it will take time and it'll take hard work.
So a moment ago, those words troth and truth, meaning truth is related to trust. It connects to what you're saying in this way. You cannot live a lie. You cannot live a lie. I have had friends who have thought that they could. I've had friends who were, you know, they were decent people, but they weren't happy at home in their life, and they were having an affair, right? And so they were living this whole separate life. It never fails. It catches up to you. It catches up to you. So if you're not being truthful about your needs and who you are and what you want, if you're not being truthful, if you're living a lie, you're presenting to people something other than who you are, well, of course you're going to get back a response and get back relationships that aren't going to be related to what you want. They're going to be related to what you projected, to the lie that you projected. And consequently, it is inevitable there will be a crash. To get to trust, You have to be truthful. You cannot live a lie. It's
not sustainable.
And that's
the self-betrayal that we're talking
about. That's right. Now, the last part of love that I think is important, and it's my favorite, definitely, is agape. Now, there's eros, again, the romantic love. There's philia, which is the brotherhood or family love. But agape is one that is almost a love of a godly love. It's a love. Now, remember, this was the Greeks who invented the word, but they believed that God had the ability to love everyone. And that means that you can even learn to love your enemies. You'd asked me on a prior show, do you really think you can love people that you don't know? And the answer is, I'm absolutely positive that you can love people that you don't know. That the men and women who ran up in the towers, in the 9/11 towers, to save people, they were showing a form of love. It's not eros, maybe not even philia.
And courage and bravery and honor.
And it's a love of
integrity
of a group of people, many of whom they would have fought with politically, mm-hmm. who they might have disagreed with mm-hmm. politically on any given issue. But they were willing to create an ultimate sacrifice for this term of agape. And agape is the concept that Martin Luther King tried to bring people to, which is that you can love other people that you don't know, and you can love your enemy. Now, his theory was that when the white nationalists, when the racist in the South were doing harmful, terrible things to African Americans, that when they would call them names, when they would call them slurs, when they would maybe beat them with sticks, that the approach that they expected back was for the black person to get angry and to respond back equally. And then they had another step that they would go beyond that, right? That the white supremacist would go beyond it. Because once they got you angry and you fought back, then they were going to take the next step. And over a period of time, what happened was the feud begins to become difficult to know who actually caused this. Who caused it? All right. Who and the media and people who were in the public would watch it and say, well, I'm not really sure who's at fault. What Martin Luther King knew was that if they responded with hatred and you responded with love and you didn't call them names and you didn't strike back and when they hit you, you didn't hit them back, that it would become very clear, one, to the public,
who the aggressor is,
who the aggressor was. But even more importantly, even to the aggressor, they didn't know how to deal with it. Mm-hmm. They didn't know how to deal with the idea that I had expected you to respond to
me
with anger.
There isn't justification now. It's not a self-defense issue any longer.
That's right. And so the whole concept that begins to fall apart in that environment is that, you know, this labeling concept is so interesting. Because when we label someone, mm-hmm. what we're really doing is this. When I say, I'll make it easy, I think that my sister is a witch, mm-hmm. right? I don't really think my sister is a witch. She's a great sister. But I think my sister is a witch. Well, then what happens is I begin to create a justification in my mind mm-hmm. for being able to do bad things to them. But through this justification, I begin to build a false reality, a box mm-hmm. for myself that's not real, right? And then what happens is other people begin to realize that I'm in this box and they become very sensitive to how they respond to me. So really only people who have similar boxes start to associate with me, mm-hmm. right? Start to talk to me, start to be part with me. And now all of a sudden I'm missing the opportunities from the people who don't do that.
To be challenged with your perceptions and your assumptions.
To be able to get mm-hmm. better, right? Well, but those labels, which are almost always labels of hate, right? Mm-hmm. When you say a Trump tard, right, mm-hmm. which is the takeoff that the liberals use because the Trumpers called them the libtards, mm-hmm. right? They're both making fun of handicapped people. They're mm-hmm. both insulting the person on the other side. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to say they're dumb. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's the benefit in that? Mm-hmm. What is the benefit that you gain by trying to take the entire group and say they're all morons, mm-hmm. right? And I get it that you're mad at them. I get it that you don't agree with them. I have feelings on that as well. But the label doesn't help you.
Yeah, and look at the issues rather than the people or groups as a whole.
And what Martin Luther King would say.
Having discussions on the issues.
If they called you a libtard, you call them brother, mm-hmm. mm. right? Because they're your brother, mm-hmm. because you're connected to them. because you're part of something bigger, and that bigger matters, right? That is agape. Agape is a godly love, and when you can find that, oh my gosh, is it empowering. Oh my gosh, and I've done it with groups where I've seen people who didn't even know one another, who could start off with these diametric positions where they hated one another. But if you could get them to talk and to communicate and to let those things down and to educate them a little bit about what it is that they're doing, they could not only find peace, they could find amazing solutions that I couldn't even imagined when we started, things that will solve very, very complex problems.
Mm-hmm. There was a great study that you're just reminding me of where they brought Israeli children and Palestinian children together. And at first, the first thing they did was identify them as the enemy and that their families are enemies and family members of their enemies. But over time, they started to play soccer together. They started to talk about what music fans they, what movies and music they liked the most. And they were teenagers and children. And over time, they found ways to bond. And then they started to see that they were more alike. They were eating together. And they started to see they were more alike than different on a human level. Because it's not just this imaginary other that you can dehumanize and vilify. It's so much harder to vilify somebody that you're in face-to-face with. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, you're able to see the connections rather than the differences.
And that definitely helps. Mm-hmm. But I want to go back to just imagining for a moment, loving somebody who's beating you with a stick.
So I have a reaction as you're talking about this. I think, okay, this is aspirational, but I wouldn't necessarily be teaching this to my clients. So I'm thinking about, you know, people who have been horrifically abused, sexually violated, or sexually victimized. And, you know, I say, I go back to you. Like, what is helping or harming or hindering you from growth? Are you learning? Are you growing? Are you transforming? Are you developing? These are the objective measures. Loving the enemy may not ever be possible for some of these people.
So.
But forgiving, finding forgiveness or empathizing or trying to understand or have compassion for the other in order to help yourself let go.
It's not possible if you only have one word for love. All right? Mm. There's a reason the Greek had seven words.
Yeah.
Right? And agape means, it is love. I mean, if you do the direct interpretation into English, it is love. But it is different. And the things that you've spoken about, I can't make recommendations on those. Those aren't my specialty. But here, let me give you some examples so you can think about it. Mm-hmm. So we know of great genocides, all right? You're Jewish, you know of the Nazi genocide, mm-hmm. you know of the Iraqi genocide because of what happened to your parents.
Yeah, the focus is on healing.
Right? Mm-hmm. You can also know what happened with Pol Pot in Cambodia, what happened in China with the Great Leap, what happened in Russia with the Gulag. But the one I like is Rwanda, right? Now, in Rwanda, there were Tutsis and Hutus. The Hutus outnumbered 10 to 1, the Tutsis. But the Tutsis, the Belgians, what they basically did is they created lines of people, and they said, okay, we're going to go through this, and the guy, the African black who has a smaller nose and that has smaller ears and has bigger eyes and that is taller and that is good looking, we're going to put in this line. And then the people who have rounder noses and rounder cheeks
arbitrary. Right?
And they separated them up.
Even in the same family member,
right.
They were dividing people up.
And they took that small group and made them house servants and had them working inside the home. And they created a separate, not race, although Hutus and Tutsis think that they are a separate race, or thought they were. They created created instead just a more isolated group that had been pulled out, who, as they began to reproduce, they reproduce the same features.
But they were originally arbitrary divides. Yeah.
The Hutus were extremely jealous. So they created this plot, And what they did on the plot was they got a right-wing radio tied into the program, and the right-wing radio, which was teaching nationalism and teaching all these terrible things, but which, by the way, every time one of these genocides happened, there's a playbook, right? Mm-hmm. You can just look at the playbook. It's always kind of the same set of steps.
Which was incited by colonizers.
That happened. But, you know, I would argue that the colonizers definitely maybe started the problem, but and maybe they created the anger, but at some point in time, you have to be accountable for yourself.
Yes.
Right?
Back to self-agency.
That's right. Self-agency. So the Hutus took this radio station and they began talking about how the Tutsis were going to shoot down their leader in an airplane. They predicted it. They predicted the date. Sure enough, it happened on that date, which pretty much tells us it was the Hutus who actually shot down their own leader, right? Mm. And when they shot them down, they told everybody to go to the Catholic churches, all the Tutsis, because they said, you are in huge trouble. So mm-hmm. they did. And when they got there, they kind of locked them in and burned the churches. They killed a million of them, right? They did unbelievable things in this country. Whether it was a general who was a Tutsi, and he helped.
The lakes were filled with blood.
Yeah, and he fought back, and he was able to actually beat the Hutus, right? Mm-hmm. However, once he got in charge, he did a couple of things that amazed me when I was in Rwanda. One was he didn't like foreign aid. He said, oh, no. Mm-hmm. This foreign aid, this is designed to corrupt our country. I want our people to be self-sufficient, right? Number two, the second thing that he did was a policy of forgiveness. He said, we're going to do court hearings where you're going to come into these court hearings.
Yeah, they have the tribunals.
And you are going to have, if your daughter was murdered and raped by a Hutu, you're going to go into the hearing, you're going to make the claim, and if he admits to it and apologizes, that you're going to hug and you're going to move on.
This is the difference between restorative justice versus retributive justice. Restorative justice is about restoring something that's been broken or taken or damaged. And it's offering healing, whereas retributive justice is more, you know, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth kind of mentality.
So it is, by the Greek's definition, agape. It is interpreted into English, love. It's just a different type, right?
And healing.
And he did that because he realized, oh my gosh, there have been so many murders, we're not going to be able to fix this unless we find a way to get people to love one another again. We have to rebuild our country, right? That we have to forgive one another. We have to forgive, we have to listen to people that we don't necessarily agree with. Oh my gosh, that's where we are here, right? And we don't have near the problem they have, not near the problem they have. And it's been over exaggerated by the media. But the problem that does exist, how are we gonna fix it? Are we gonna fix it by when a Trumper calls you a libtard, by you calling them a Trumptard? I don't think so. I don't think that's going to work. I think it's just going to go in the exact opposite direction. Nobody's going to know who started the fight.
Yeah.
Right? What you have to do is you have to find love. You have to find forgiveness. You can love your enemy. And loving your enemy is about how you treat them and the respect that you give them and the willingness to live with them. And again, I can't tell you how this advice will work with a sexually assaulted person, but I know how it works in a community. It works. It's effective. And I've seen it work on nation levels, and I've seen it work in local neighborhoods.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that we're not giving the wrong recommendation or it's not being heard in the wrong way. I think, you know, if you're looking at somebody who's been victimized by horrific acts, we're not just saying, oh, this is a blanket thing and that you can just achieve this and be well on your way to living a happy, healthy, healed life. No, that's not the case. Ultimately, and this is the work that I do, is it comes back to you. You know, how do you want to feel about yourself day to day? Where is your power? Are you giving your power away? How do you maintain your self-agency? How do you want to go to bed sleeping about yourself that night? How do you want to wake up feeling about yourself the next morning? Rather than feeling helpless or seeing yourself as continually victimized, how do we empower you? And it may come through the work of forgiveness, and finding ways to heal yourself may be about letting go of that pain and moving on and not holding on to that hatred or holding on to that spite or that jealousy or envy or whatever those things are that are preventing you from being able to move forward. You can operationally, objectively evaluate, am I learning? Am I growing? Am I healing? Am I transforming?
Yeah, and Martin Luther King, he wasn't saying, hey, you know what we need to do? We need to go to a Ku Klux Klan meeting and go to their living room and sit down and give them all big hugs mm-hmm. and just love them to death. That's a different kind of love. That's more philia, right? What he was saying was, and he wrote great treatise on this. He was saying, no, we need to treat them with love. We need to treat them with love. And that love is the type of love that he believed God gives, that it's more divine, right? And by the way, that, again, that word, it's the God of the Greeks, it's the God of Jehovah, it can be Mother Nature, but it's about a power that's bigger than me. And that, I believe, that agape comes from that source. Mm-hmm. I also believe, and there are some people I can mentor, some people I can't. I can mentor people with extreme anger. I'm not really good at mentoring people with psychological conditions, right? That's mm-hmm. kind of more your field. But there's only one answer to extreme hatred. There's no way you can find your sense of agency if you're mad and angry, holding grudges against someone who really did something that harmed you. If mm-hmm. you are a victim, you are not going to find peace.
And I think it's also a matter of finding balance. I know we're talking about love and connection here, but I go back to, you know, the work that I did with Indigenous communities, and they have a really beautiful philosophy. There was a time and a place where you have to practice the warrior way, and there's a time and a place where you have to practice the loving way. And there is sometimes a place for both, or one or the other. And you know, we're not trying to give blanket statements or prescriptions for all things at all times, for all people. That's not what we're trying to do here. But I think the main important thing is, where does it go back? Where is there benefit to your life? Mm-hmm. How are you living your life? Really dissect and analyze and take the time to really uncover who you are. You just said a moment ago, okay, I'm not talking about people with psychological conditions. I said, well, we all have psychological conditions, Paul.
Maybe me the most.
I don't know who does it, but
okay,
you know.
So everything gets dumbed down into a political term. So, all right. So we've got just a few minutes here. Let's try to distill this down to some lessons that maybe are helpful for people. Mm-hmm. I'll give what I think is the first one. The first one is that hate and envy hold you onto the past. Love lets you go. All right. If you can find it, maybe you can't. Maybe there are reasons you can't. But if you don't, if you're hateful, if you're envious, if you're spiteful, it is holding you on to your past, and you're not going to be able to move forward.
Yeah, you know, and labels that we use for other people, not only are we putting other people into boxes, we're putting ourselves into boxes, and it's limiting our wide perspective. Mm-hmm. And it's preventing us from having wisdom, from having growth. We need to practice insight in order to really understand and appreciate, you know, the more we tell ourselves that we're unlike this other person, probably the more you are like that person. So be aware of what you're projecting, because likely you're projecting something onto others. It could be your spouse. It could be your children. It could be your boss, that you're projecting these things onto them. But really, it's inherently saying something about you.
Mm-hmm. All right. Don't give up on the people you love for the people you don't even know. Politics has a way of overcoming your best judgment. Issues have the way of overcoming your best judgment. The greatest asset you have is right in front of you. It's right in front of you. It's your children, your parents, your sisters, your brothers, your family members, your friends, and they're never perfect, ever. I don't care who you are. You can look at the wealthiest people, people that you think have the most charm lives. They're always stressed to a degree. But don't give up on those people you love for the people that wouldn't even return your phone call.
Yes. The next one is gratitude. And I just want to teach a quick skill here. So one of the things that I often would teach my clients is opposite to emotion, action. So if you're feeling anger.
Opposite to emotion, action. Okay.
Mm-hmm. And if you're feeling anger or anxiety, fear, jealousy, envy, any of those emotions that are keeping you stuck or trapped, I would say think about what could you do to get you to feel that other emotion. And so you want to go to the opposite side of that spectrum. Gratitude is one of those quick ways to get you there. And you can always find at least one thing to be grateful for, even in a dire situation. So think about saying, oh my gosh, this could have been worse. And this situation would have been worse.
Are these just like neutralizers to things that you have when you do gratitude? Do you meditate on them? How do you actually experience gratitude?
Well, you have to have that insight. You have to take that moment, find that calm place, ground yourself to be able to get to that place. And then you need to do an internal tracker where you have to look at your thoughts, your cognitions. You have to look at your emotions. What is your physiology telling you about what's going on in your body? And looking at your actions. Once you've identified all of these things, you're now able to track what's going on internally where you can make that shift. And gratitude is a quick way to make that shift into another state of being that is going to help you to find calm. It's going to help you to find something to appreciate and be grateful for in that moment, no matter how dire this situation is, because it's going to prevent you from going down that loop that is going to keep you stuck and trapped and feeling hopeless or helpless or angry. That's going to prevent you from doing or saying something that you might regret later.
All right, and I'm going to do one more, and I'll let you do the last one. But the one that I would like to do is I want to put just, again, a focus on loving your enemy. You know, when I was mayor, we had a governor by the name of Evan Meekum, who had gotten rid of the Martin Luther King Day as his first action. He'd made a number of kind of wild comments over time, and he ended up being impeached later on. But the story that was important is that when they got rid of the Martin Luther King Day, there was a vote, and we lost the vote. When we lost the vote, I worked hard to get a group of people to put it back on the ballot and to go forward again. And at that period of time, there was a guy named Paul Tagliabue, who was running the NFL, and a guy who owned the Philadelphia Eagles. And they wanted to take the Super Bowl away from Phoenix. So what they did was they used this as a reason to take the Super Bowl out of Phoenix and move it into one of the other markets, which just happened to be more profitable. And I certainly didn't blame Paul Tagliabue on that, but I did blame the owner of the Eagles. Now, I did two things. One was the owner of the Eagles was had a car lot in Philadelphia, and so I just called and asked if they were going to be opened up on Martin Luther King Day. And they said that they were going to be, and so I called the media in Philadelphia and said, hey, if this guy's going to be the moral watchdog, maybe he ought to close down his own shop. And it caused people to just kind of go crazy there in his own community about his hypocrisy. But in our own community, what I knew was how powerful that message of losing the Super Bowl was, but not in our favor. That if you created this environment where it was, we're going to take something from you to teach you a lesson, that the citizens of my community would react badly, that they would then say, you can't tell us what to do. So what I did instead is I tried to get them to focus on love. And here's how I did it. True story, there was a little boy that I went out to, and he was in a neighborhood. I went into this neighborhood with my mayor's car, and the kids came around all wanting to see what it was like and see the thing on top. And finally, this one little boy, African-American boy, said, Mayor, do you think that people voted against Martin Luther King Day because he was black? Now, I did my best to try to explain it to him that it wasn't true, right? That's not why the Martin Luther King Day went down. It wasn't about Martin Luther King. It wasn't about his skin color. It was about all these other things, right? But I said, the bottom line to it is, here's one little boy growing up in our community who believes that his opportunities might not be the same as everyone else's because of the color of his skin. Mm-hmm. I said, there's the reason. There's the reason. The amount of support that I got on that one issue was unbelievable. Mm-hmm. People could tie into loving a little boy they didn't even know, that they'd never met, that they'd never seen.
Yeah, because there's the innocence in the childhood.
You can't really move your community forward by hate. Mm-hmm. It will work for a period of time. Mm-hmm. But to really accomplish the great things, you have to use agape. Mm-hmm. You have to use love.
Beautiful. Oh my gosh. That one's a powerful one. Well, I think, you know, the other one is we talked about forgiveness, and I think some of this is also self-forgiveness. So really being cautious with how hard you are on yourself, not just how hard you are on others, allowing yourself the grace. Treat yourself with grace. And I think when you can get there, you can also extend it to others.
All right. Thank you, Emily.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul.
So let's see. This is our fifth one. I know we have a couple more that are left. You know, the whole focus of our show has been to try to make certain that we help people find that they find their sense of agency. And this show is not only designed to try and help you find your own agency, but when you know of other people that are struggling, to be able to do the same thing. In that regard, if you're watching the show and you liked it, not only subscribe, but forward it on to other friends. Thanks again. This is Paul Johnson, Dr. Emily Bascia, here talking about hope, love, and connection. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining the Optimistic American Show. Now help us grow by subscribing to our channel. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a like and a comment. There is so much more that we have planned. We can't wait for you to embark upon this journey with us.